Good afternoon, everybody. Please be seated. Our final case this morning, this afternoon, is 69012, Dish Network Derivative Litigation, Dish Network Derivative Litigation. Mr. Silvestri for the appellants, Mr. Peek for the respondents. Justice Perigary will be listening to this, and we'll conference on this later this week. He'll be involved in this decision. Mr. Silvestri, are you ready?
Yes,
I am. Thank you. Mr. Silvestri, Mr. Peek, I just have one comment before we get started and the clock starts. As you know, we're trying to develop our business court case law here, and although the parties haven't specifically addressed if we should adopt one of the cases, Auerbach versus Bennett and Zapata Court versus Maldonado, I'll be interested in each of your takes, considering not only this case in the future, if this is an appropriate opinion, related case for us to write on.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. Jeff Silvestri on behalf of appellants. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if possible. The district court in this case erred in granting the motion to defer and in dismissing the underlying complaint after it concluded that there are no issues of fact, that the special litigation committee in this case acted independently and in good faith and thoroughly in determining that Dish would not pursue the $800 million claim against Mr. Irvin. The SLC was created in this case because the board of directors was admittedly conflicted. It admitted it was not independent of Mr. Irvin. It could not thoroughly and in good faith evaluate this claim, which is no surprise, given that the Federal Bankruptcy Court, who was evaluating this case right around the same time, evaluating the same claims, identified Mr. Irvin as the controlling shareholder who picked every member of this board of directors, and that not a single member of that board would ever cross or question Mr. Irvin. That's the formula under which the board decided it would hand select the Special Litigation Committee to evaluate this claim. And when evaluating the motion to defer, which is an issue of first impression, the court should be cognizant of the fact that every other court, and you won't see any citation in the record from the SLC that says the same, every court holds an SLC to the highest standard of review. The highest level of scrutiny to ensure that that SLC, when it's done, can get the same type of business judgment deference that a board of directors would. And rigorous scrutiny is required because of what an SLC is. The SLC is formed when the board can't do its job. Somebody has to evaluate whether this claim is going to go forward or not, and that's what the SLC does. It essentially supplants the judiciary and supplants the judge in its fact-finding mission. That SLC is supposed to independently review the claim, and when it's done, if it's done independently, and it reviews it thoroughly, and it makes a decision, the district court will give it deference. But because the district court's and the trial court's review process and powers are so constricted, it's not really the fact-finder anymore. Its job is to evaluate the evaluators. And when they're evaluating the evaluators, which is the SLC, they need to hold it to the highest standards. So we know that that group is just as independent as the judge would have been. This is the only place in American jurisprudence where this happens. And that's why all the courts who evaluate it say that that SLC needs rigorous scrutiny. And the standard, while this is an issue of first impression, the tests that the court uses are not. It comes from Schoen. It comes from Auerbach and Zapata, which both sides agree to. And the facts in this case are so egregious that if the court grants deference and says that the district court here was appropriate in granting deference to this SLC, there's not a single SLC that can be created that won't get deference. These facts are so beyond the pale and so far outside of what every other case has been cited. The district court here erred three ways. The first thing it did is it provided a presumption of independence and good faith to the SLC, which no other court has done, and which Zapata and Auerbach said you cannot do. It then required the appellants to overcome that burden, which is contrary to the summary judgment standard in and of itself. It limited its constriction, secondly, it limited its evaluation of dependence, beholdenness, independence, to financial dependence only. Even though this court in Schoen has said, beholdenness is evaluated under any circumstance wherein a person cannot evaluate the claims under merits, but would be open to influence from other considerations. Schoen itself was a case where it wasn't necessarily financial independence. It was a case of personal ties. Third, and most importantly, the district court, by looking at it through this lens of providing presumptions and restricting its analysis, just got it wrong on the issues of fact. All that the appellants had to show was that in the light most favorable to the appellants, a reasonable person could conclude that this SSC was not independent and was not acting in good faith. There are high standards to begin with, and they should be.
Mr. Silvestri?
Yes.
If I may, say for purposes of argument that the third director, the what was independent, and they had that unique voting structure where the third person could veto it. Would that pass muster?
It certainly would not, and it wouldn't pass muster for multiple reasons. First, you have the Booth Family Trust cases saying, since the SLC gets to pick its perfectly independent board, it needs to pick a perfectly independent board. Now remember, the board of directors got to pick this SLC. It got to pick anybody it wanted, and this is the group it picked. It's not an independent board. Moreover, under the Schoen case, this court has already precluded that analysis. Under the Schoen case, which is a demand futility case, slightly different, because in that case, the board agrees that it's already independent, but the court is still going to evaluate beholdenness. It already said, this court has said, if a majority of the directors are not independent, then the board, then the SLC is not independent. And so you're looking at it in total. Moreover, the facts of this case would not allow for the analysis and the consideration that the district court gave. Mr. Orthoff and Mr. Volkow were so conflicted. And if what we're trying to do is find the board that is completely independent, this was not it. And they should not be allowed. Mr. Lewis was only brought in this court after it was clear that this SLC was bound to Mr. Irvin. And the post facto effort to put Mr. Lewis on the board and then say, well, if Mr. Lewis agrees, then it's okay. That's not how Special Litigations Committee works. This is so unique that you'll never find another case cited that's like where you have a conflicted board that tries to cure itself by adding one person who's arguably independent, and we don't consent that he is. We believe that he's not independent.
Mr. Silvestri, I see it. Yes. You went through your 3 points. Let's go back to the third point. You're basically arguing we should apply a summary judgment standard here. Yes. On the genuine issues of material fact. What's the legal basis for
it's
that?
It's Auerbach and Zapata. Both cases say, and the Hassan case confirms, that Auerbach and Zapata say when you're evaluating a motion to defer, you use a summary judgment standard. It's not a true summary judgment because when it's over, if issues of fact exist, the court doesn't go back and decide the issue of independence or good faith. It's the threshold bar that the SLC has to meet. It has to convince the court that in order to get deference, it has to pass that issues of fact summary judgment test. Both sides agree to it. Both sides put in their brief that Auerbach or Zapata absolutely applied this.
Okay, thank you.
So when we're talking about the SLC and we talk about the issues of fact, what issues of fact exist? Okay, what we're looking for in independence is beholdenness. And from the Schoen Court, Justice Hardesty's opinion, the question is whether the evaluator can base it on the corporate merits of the subject before it rather than on extraneous considerations or influence. Citing a case from Delaware Hyzinga, which is a case purely about personal interactions. Whether a CEO's brother-in-law could sit on an SLC and evaluate his actions, which that court, by the way, said, not even close. That creates so many issues of fact that that board could never be considered independent. The Schoen case itself was a question that, while it involved financial questions of financial dependence, it also resolved and involved questions of personal interactions between families, which this court said was absolutely sufficient. And so, who is Mr. Brokaw and Mr. Orthoff who start this process? They're the two people who start the SLC. Mr. Orthoff is part of the board of directors of DISH, hand-selected by Mr. Irvin, that the Federal Bankruptcy Court has already said would never cross Mr. Irvin or question him. If that doesn't raise issues of fact alone, what does? Mr. Orthoff is on the special transaction. Mr. Orthoff had just disbanded the Special Transaction Committee, which was an independent body, which once it was disbanded, the Federal Bankruptcy Court again said that was astonishing in its brazenness, given the enabling language. Mr. Orthoff had a 40-year loving, familial relationship with the Irvins. The Irvin kids called him Uncle Tom. They vacationed together. They spent family vacations and holidays together. They went around the world, Switzerland, Peru, Nepal, Taiwan, Japan. They told each other's families that they loved each other. They reciprocated. Mr. Orthoff, on the eve of the SLC report, writes a letter to Mr. Irvin and his wife saying, I appreciate in this time of personal hardship that you're with me. I love and respect you. You're my true friend. You know, this is not the person independent. This is not the person who, I mean, a reasonable person can look at this and say, that person is not going to file against Mr. Kirby. Uncle Tom is not going to file an $800 million claim against the person he says he loves and respects and vacations with and has a 40 or 50 year relationship with. This is exactly identical to the Sanchez case we cited, where the district, the court in that case said, somebody with a 40 or 50 year relationship obviously gets tremendous benefit from it. That's going to be something that raises issues of fact. The district court didn't think so. But it's clear that issues of fact exist. The same with Mr. Brokaw. Mr. Brokaw has the same long-term, love and familiar relationship. Mr. Brokaw is the godfather. I'm sorry, Mrs. Ergen, the wife of Mr. Ergen, is the godmother to Mr. Brokaw's son. They vacation together. They talk about each other. They dote on their kids. They stay in each other's houses. They tell each other that they love them. The board could have picked anybody on the SLC they wanted, but the first thing they did was they put Mr. Ergen's two closest friends on them. That creates issues of fact as to whether the evaluators are going to be fair. Would this court believe that a three-judge panel, even looking at this, with the defendant's two best friends on it, and the third person was arguably independent, would that pass muster? Would this court think that was raised no issues of fact? Of course not. We want our evaluators to be truly independent and act in good faith and evaluate thoroughly. Which goes to the next question of, was there a good faith and thorough investigation? And again, questions of fact exist. This board was formed, the SLC was formed, on the heels of the transaction committee being disbanded. Everybody knew that you didn't cross Mr. Irving. Mr. Orloff knew it. He was on the board, and he disbanded that transaction committee. But he ends up on the special litigation committee with Mr. Brokaw at the beginning. So the board starts out stacked, and it starts out with two people who understand not to cross Mr. Ergen. The question is, did they prejudge? What did they do at the beginning of this? The first thing they said was that the SLC believed that Mr. Ergen's interest aligned with board and with the boards the SLC identified that it thought Mr. Ergen's interest aligned with the shareholders and the board. This was before they did any investigation. This is what the investigation was for, to determine that very question. In the middle of the case, they get in court, the SLC's counsel, and tells the district court, the SLC is fully aligned on this side of the V as the board and Mr. Ergen. That's the issue right there. The SLC shouldn't be aligned with anybody. The SLC telling the court, we are aligned with the person we're investigating, raises issues of fact as to whether this is an independent and good faith investigation. At the end, the SLC ignores the Federal Bankruptcy Court's opinion. And this opinion is critical. The Bankruptcy Court was evaluating the same claims that are at issue here. Mr. Ergen's spectrum purchases. The Bankruptcy Court had a weeks-long trial with multiple witnesses, and in the end issued a 175-page opinion, which essentially said Mr. Ergen did what the complaint said. He was untruthful in his testimony. He used his own resources to buy the spectrum for personal profit. He could have acquired the spectrum for DISH itself, but didn't, and the board was complicit. The Special Litigation Committee ignored that. This is not a question where we're asking the court to nitpick this investigation. Should they have looked at one issue over another? The wholesale review of how this investigation happened shows that it was prejudged. It's stacked. It starts from everybody knowing you don't cross Mr. Ergen. It's stacked with Mr. Ergen's two best friends. At the start, middle, and end, they say, we're aligned with Mr. Ergen. That's not what this is supposed to be for. This court should uphold the standards from Schoen. It should enforce all Arbacher's upon it. Both say the same thing. The standard of summary judgment. There's no presumptions given. The court should follow the test from Schoen about independence. It's a broad review, and the court should give strict and high scrutiny to this SLC. Because if it doesn't, it's not going to do what the defendants say. If this court gives strict scrutiny to this SLC, it's not going to open the floodgates to litigation. What it's going to do is ensure that an SLC can get the same protections and deference that a board would. And it's going to make sure that the board picks correctly, the judiciary is comfortable with what happened, and the shareholders can be comfortable that an absolute independent evaluation is done. If the court doesn't uphold it, if the court upholds what the district court did, and allows deference to this SLC, it's basically allowing anything. What it's doing is opening the floodgates, not to litigation, but to corporate abuse. Because a corporate director will know that he can do anything he wants, loot the company, do whatever, and when the time comes to evaluate it, he just needs to appoint a special litigation committee that are his friends.
Mr. Silvestri?
Yes.
If you have an independent board, then what level of deference is their decision-making due?
In this case, I don't think, we never really got to that case because the judge didn't get to the next level to see if the board, if the court then would do the searching evaluation of the board's, of the SSC's decision. Now, it would be more consistent that as far as the corporate structure, that there's deference is given under our regular corporate model, because if the STC is basically identical to an independent corporate board, there's not necessarily a need to do further investigation. That issue never came right before the court, because she did dismiss the complaint before we ever got there.
Mr. Silvestri, you used up all your time, and I'll give you 2 minutes of rebuttal, and Mr. Peake, I'll give you 17 minutes. I'll give you the two extra.
Thank you.
Well, two for you and 17 for Mr. Peake.
I sure I'll need that much time, but thank you very much. Have a seat. Appreciate it.
Mr. Peake, again, if you would address the standard, I have a great deal of concern about the summary judgment related standard. What is it from your point of view under Zapata and Auerbach?
Thank you, and I will address that. So, good afternoon, Your Honor. Stephen Peake on behalf of the Special Litigation Committee of Dish Network. The court should affirm the district court's decision for four reasons. First, based upon the evidence, the district court made factual findings that the SLC was independent, acted independently, and conducted a good faith, thorough investigation. The findings are not clearly erroneous and are supported by substantial evidence. As this court has already determined in Schoen and in Reynolico, if a board or committee is independent and conducted a good faith, thorough investigation, its decision is protected by the business judgment rule and is final. There's no reason for the court to reconsider established Nevada law. Second, Jacksonville's alternative standards are also inconsistent with the statutory presumption of NRS 78-138 subpart 3. That, quote, directors in deciding upon matters of business are presumed to act in good faith on an informed basis and with a view to the interests of the corporation, end quote. In Delaware and many of the other jurisdictions upon which Jacksonville relies, the business judgment rule is judge-made and courts are sometimes free to depart from it. Not so in Nevada. In Nevada, the presumption of good faith and independence is imposed by statute, and that statute admits of no exceptions for special litigation committees. Third, even if Nevada law permitted the truncated process advocated by Jacksonville, in which the district court cut short its evaluation of independence upon the mere identification of a genuine issue of material fact, the district court's decision should still be affirmed. To address Jacksonville's proposed standard, the district court correctly held in the alternative and after considering all the evidence presented at the hearing that there was not a genuine issue of material fact, that the SLC was independent, that it acted independently, and that it conducted a good faith, thorough investigation.
What about all these personal relationships that Mr. Silvestri raised?
The court heard the evidence on the personal relationships. And with respect to the personal relationships of Mr. Hertzog and Mr. Brokaw, what the court said in its finding was, given the structure of the vote of the committee, that coupled with all the evidence that it received and that it heard, she determined that the SLC acted independently, was independent, and acted independently. One thing that Mr. Silvestri doesn't point out to you is that typically, not only in Schoen, but in the case that they cite, you have to have not only the friendly, familiar relationship, but the beholdenness. We say that even in Schoen. The same principle applies in Schoen, because Schoen talks about beholdenness and there are other reasons. And the case that they cite, for example, Sanchez was a case in Delaware in which the court combined both the personal relationship as well as the financial beholdenness. Because remember that the two employees worked for a subsidiary.
So your argument basically is, as far as the standard, that's what I'm trying to get at, is similar to a bench trial standard. We give deference to the findings of fact of the district court, not as Rule 56, is there a genuine issue of material fact?
Yes.
Now, Mr. Silvestri says under both Zapata and Auerbach, it's this genuine issue of material fact standard.
And I'm going to get to that. I apologize for not answering your question. I'm going to use my time wisely, and hopefully I'm going to get to your question because I want to get to at least my 4 points.
Okay.
Jacksonville's truncated process is also inconsistent with Schoen and Amoco. In both decisions, this court held that a plaintiff could not proceed with derivative claims unless and until the district court held an evidentiary hearing and made factual findings that the board lacked independence or did not act in good faith, such that demand on the board would have been futile. The same should apply here. A stockholder should not usurp control of a corporation's legal claims without factual findings that a special litigation committee's decision cannot be trusted. Now, with respect to your question, I don't think that Auerbach or Zapata are necessarily either one that we should apply, because I think we have the application here. We have a statutory scheme. We have 78.138 subpart 3, which gives us the presumption. We have both Schoen, I'll call Schoen 1 and Schoen 2, if you will, that guide us and that tell us when the particularized allegation within the complaint, that does not stop. You still have to hold an evidentiary hearing. Because of the presumption that exists within 78.138 subpart 3, where it says, boards are presumed to act in good faith. Directors are presumed to act in good faith. You can only overcome that presumption by having a hearing, an evidentiary hearing. Delaware and New York and Auerbach, Delaware and Zapata, don't have similar evidentiary hearings. Now, that's not to say that Auerbach and Zapata might give guidance to us, because they would give guidance to us. But I say that we already have a body of jurisprudence based upon Schoen 1, Schoen 2, and the statutory scheme of Chapter 78, which is unique to Nevada. Jacksonville complains that the district court did not hold an evidentiary hearing, but the district court received evidence and conducted the factual analysis required by Schoen, Amoco, and NRS 78.
Witnesses or just affidavits or what? What did the hearing consist of?
The hearing consisted of a briefing and appendices. So if you look at the appendix that the Jacksonville submitted in their supplemental brief, it was an appendix that contained 101 exhibits, which included the entire transcript of each of the depositions of the three members of the SLC. It included transcripts from the bankruptcy. It included the transcript of Charlie Ergen. It included the interviews. So if you look at those 101 exhibits that the court had at its fingertips when they were submitted to the court and were argued at the hearing in July of 2015, that record, that supplemental briefing, has all of the evidence.
So you're saying like the Depositions Act is the same as live testimony?
They do. And we went for that. We have NRCP 43C. 43C allows the court discretion to either hold that hearing or take evidence by deposition. So at the conclusion of the first hearing, remember that at the conclusion of the first hearing in January of 2015, upon the motion to defer, Jacksonville requested discovery concerning the SLC's independence, their thoroughness, and good faith nature of the investigation. The district court granted that motion. That was at 11th hour request. Jacksonville conducted months of discovery thereafter, and Jacksonville, in those months of discovery, conducted the depositions of all three members of the SLC. Is that evidence that they now present to you about the relationships of Hortoff, Brokaw, and Lillis to Mr. Ergen? After that supplemental briefing, the district court held another hearing. And at that time, as I said, Justice Gibbons, Jackson Bell submitted the evidence it chose, not only in the demonstrative PowerPoint that they presented, but also that appendix of over 101 exhibits consisting of almost 3,000 pages of evidence that they had obtained during the course of discovery. That less than 3,000 pages came from the 20-some-odd thousand pages we produced in discovery, as well as the thousands of pages that we produced along the way from the Lexcorp bankruptcy. Although Jacksonville did not call live witnesses, it certainly could have been able to do so. It instead submitted the depositions and the transcripts from the depositions and the interviews that we conducted in pursuant to NICP 43C. Jacksonville, interestingly, does not complain that it was deprived of any discovery, does not claim that there was any discovery that it could have elicited, nor does it contend that there is further evidence to present at some future hearing concerning the SLC's independence or investigation. Instead, they rely upon this short form of, if I show a mere issue of fact, game over, I get to proceed. No evidentiary hearing. I'm going to ignore the presumption of 78. I'm going to ignore Amoco, all of which say that the court must hold an evidentiary hearing. Jacksonville says the district court did not make factual findings, but it did. At the conclusion of the hearing, the district court requested proposed factual findings. Jacksonville did not object to those requested findings, nor did it object to the district court making factual findings. The district court's ruling includes 90 separate and numbered findings of fact, including findings addressing the independence of the SLC, as well as the good faith and thoroughness of the SLC's investigation. For example, the district court found, quote, after considering the evidence concerning the independence of Messrs. Brokaw and Ortoff, together with the evidence concerning the independence of Mr. Lewis and his voting power, the court is persuaded that the SLC as a whole was independent and acted independently. Jacksonville claims now for the first time in its reply brief to this court that the district court lacked authority to make factual findings without a further evidentiary hearing, but that argument is waived. That argument is waived when it was not raised at the district court level pursuant to NRCP Rule 46, and was waived again when it was not raised in Jacksonville's opening brief to this court. But as I just said, that is of no moment because Jacksonville has already presented its evidence and had the opportunity to present the evidence and did so. Jacksonville says that the district court merely presumed that the SLC was independent, placing the burden on Jacksonville to rebut the presumption. But the district court's factual findings show that this is also not true. Although it would have been proper, as I argue, for the district court to place the burden on Jacksonville, the court indulged Jacksonville by not doing so. The district court wrote, the court need not address the issue of burden because it concludes that the SLC was independent and conducted a good faith, thorough investigation, irrespective of which party bears the burden. Jacksonville contends for the first time in reply.
How does it get to the finding of independence as to the two, not Lewis so much, but as to the two? How does the court justify that finding?
Two ways. The voting structure is one. Actually, three ways. The voting structure is one. The lack of
Lewis, it's like the pardons board. If we don't have the governor's vote, there's no...
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes, Justice McGreen. Secondly, the lack of any beholdenness, financial beholdenness, on the part of them, because family relationships standing alone would not...
But are you translating, are you transporting demand futility analysis to the special litigation committee analysis, and is that appropriate in that setting, the latter setting?
I think under the business judgment rule under 78-138, subpart 3, yes it is.
Okay, so you would distinguish Zapata and Auerbach on the grounds that special litigation committees should just be analyzed under the same independence rubric as in the demand futility
yes.
setting?
Okay. Yes.
And then you had a third point, I'm sorry.
apologize, but I believe I've forgotten the third point, is that the lack of beholdenness, the special voting power, and the fact that what the court said was that they acted independently. That was the third point. She made a finding that they acted independently. So not only a matter of independence, but acted independently in coming to their conclusion.
So you would maintain that the two directors on whom Jacksonville focuses, you would say they could pass the Schoen-Amurco, they could be in that determination of demand futility?
Yes. It's interesting because I actually was involved in the Schoen 2 evidentiary process, where we dealt with Hat Hardy, John Dodd, Brogan, and Grogan, and developed that same evidence that led to...
So you said they can do that, and therefore that's good for the Special Litigation Committee?
I think that they can do that, yes, because I don't think that given the nature of their familial, that sort of godfather, I don't think it's a family relationship, as well as given the friendships, that those standing alone without the additional concept of beholdenness is not sufficient to disqualify them.
What about if we didn't have our statutory scheme and we were straight under Auerbach and Zapata? Would your answer still be the same?
Yes. And I look, for example, to guidance from Sanchez. That's the recent case that was decided by Jacksonville. Sanchez was a case where there was a very close relationship between the director and the two members of the SLC, mm-hmm. and those two members had both a beholdenness and a personal relationship. And so the Delaware Supreme Court said, based upon that combination, they are not independent. And there are many other cases, Your Honor, that say that family relationship or friendship relations standing alone do not make a person independent or
dependent.
Not independent. Not independent.
Okay.
Jacksonville contends for the first time in its reply that the district court's factual findings should be reversed. But Jacksonville did not make this argument in its opening brief, so that argument again was waived. Even if the argument is not waived, Jacksonville cannot meet the clearly erroneous standard for reversal because the district court's factual findings were supported by substantial evidence, devoid of even a genuine issue of material fact. There was no genuine issue of fact as to Mr. Lewis's independence, nor was any question that under its governing resolutions that the SLC could not act without Mr. Lewis's approval. Due to Mr. Lewis's required approval, the independence of Mrs. Brokaw and Brokaw matters only to the extent as to whether the SLC in fact functioned independently. Despite the limited discovery, Jacksonville has yet to identify a single instance in which the SLC acted less than independently. As the district court correctly found, and as we detail in our papers, there was no narrow community of Jacksonville that does not have a
I'll give you another minute, and then I'll give you Mr. Peake.
Thank you.
Another minute, Mr. Peake.
Let me talk about Jacksonville's truncated process, because that's, I think, where we're coming to, and why it should be rejected. First, it would be inconsistent with Nevada's business judgment rule. It would require rejecting the decision of the Special Litigation Committee upon the mere showing of an issue, mere raising of an issue, rejecting the decision of a committee that the court may find to be disinterested, independent, and fully informed runs directly counter to the business judgment rule. And here, of course, the district court has already found this committee to be independent. Second, it would be inconsistent with NRS 78.138 subpart 3. The mere raising of an issue does not rebut the statutory presumption. Directors on a special litigation committee must be treated as independent, acting in good faith, and fully informed unless and until factual determinations are made to the contrary. Third, it would be inconsistent with NRS 78.125, which treats a board committee the same as the full board. Since Shane Lamacore applied the business judgment rule to the decision of the full board, absent factual findings overcoming the business judgment rule, the same would be true for the board committee, such as the special litigation committee. Absent being clearly erroneous and supported by substantial evidence, the district court's decision should be affirmed. Thank you very much. Thank you for the additional time.
Thank you, Your Honors. That argument and that position was shocking in the extent how different it was to what they asked for in the district court. Nobody asked for an evidentiary hearing in the district court. Nobody thought the motion to defer was an evidentiary hearing. The defendant at that point had submitted Auerbach and Zapata apply. They had told the court, this is a summary judgment standard. They never asked for an evidentiary hearing. It wasn't treated as an evidentiary hearing. Nobody thought it was supposed to be done under Schoen. This was going to be done under Auerbach and Zapata. They can't now come back and say this should have been an evidentiary hearing standard. If that's the case, you need to reverse, because there was never an evidentiary hearing. But it shouldn't be under that standard. This is different from Schoen. You have, in this case, a board who is admittedly conflicted. NRS 78.125 presumptions can't be transmuted to the SLC. Perhaps if the board was itself independent, the presumptions could be transmuted. But when the board itself admits it is 100% captured by Mr. Ergen, and it admits in setting forth the SLC that it can't establish it, we're in a different world. We're not in Schoen. They'd be holding the standard from Schoen applies. And I noticed that Mr. Peake interchanged beholdenness with financial independence. That's not the case. Beholdenness means broad, financial, personal, otherwise.
Mr. Sylvester, let me get this straight. In this case, did Mr. Peake's clients argue to Judge Gonzalez that the summary judgment standard applies as far as the review?
They certainly did, because they cited and said Auerbach and Zapata apply. In their briefs, you can see summary judgment standard applies. The district court's opinion says no genuine issues of material fact exist. That's summary judgment. There's no question that this was not an evidentiary hearing under Schoen, because everybody understood we were outside of it. And Justice Pickering, to your question, this is a different consideration. We're using that test from inside of Schoen. And when we talk about financial or beholdenness or independence, yes, we're talking about the same tests, but we're doing so with a much higher standard, with a much broader evaluation and look to make sure that SLC is independent, because again, it was hand-selected by an automatically and admittedly conflicted board. And if this court's going to say that the Schoen standards and evaluation apply to an SLC, then why have an SLC? And to the point of, you know, what about Mr. Ortloff and Mr. Brokaw? Under Mr. Peake's analysis, you might as well have just put Mr. Ergen and his wife on that board, and it still apparently would have satisfied the standard of something that no issue of fact exists as to independence. No question.
You would maintain that every member needs to be independent, and that regardless of the structure of the committee being sort of like the Pardons Board, where the one independent...
At a minimum, the majority has to be independent under Schoen. At a minimum, Schoen said...
Especially if the one guy has a total veto.
The way this committee was set up, and the facts are important, it was set up with Mr. Ortolf and Mr. Brokaw, and only after we presented the conflicts did they come up with this scheme to put Mr. Lewis on to try to save it. But because Booth Family Trust tells us, the board gets its chance, pick a perfectly independent SLC, anybody you want. You can't just pick two people that are loaded and stacked and then put one person on there who's arguably independent and then say we've washed our hands of it. We have created something that everybody can trust and not one person can say raises an issue of fact. We think this case should be... I'm sorry, Justice Harris.
If I may, Justice Pickering, had you finished your question?
I have, thank
okay.
you.
in reviewing the judge's order at pages 24, 25, and 26, Mr. Sylvester, where the judge discusses the standard of review, it seems to me that the judge is making the point that Zapata and Auerbach stand for the outcome of the deference determination. I don't see in the standard of review discussions at paragraphs 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 a declaration by the judge that the summary judgment standard is the standard that the judge is applying. In fact, she makes the observation that under either Zapata or Auerbach, the issue isn't determinative. So I acknowledge that the judge has cited those two cases, but I don't think that the judge in her order is saying that this is a summary judgment standard of review. She certainly hasn't said so specifically.
She might not have said so specifically, but in the remainder of the language, it's clear that it was a summary judgment standard, and it's clear when looking at the underlying briefs that the parties are presenting to the court, that we are presenting to the court, issues of fact exist. The SLC is presenting to the court, issues of fact do not exist. That's the rubric under which the court is analyzing this. And when both parties are telling the court, Auerbach and Zapata apply, and Auerbach and Zapata both stand for the proposition, and these are the leading cases. There's nothing else that anybody cites. Everybody cites Auerbach and Zapata. And they both say, this is a summary judgment standard. And it's the burden of the SLC to present to the court that no issues of fact exist as to the independence and good faith. And it's not just a free for all.
Let's explore that moment. It's pretty clear that under our business judgment rule, we have said there's a presumption that the directors, I understand the issue about the committee. That's a separate question. But assuming that the court were to conclude that the committee was entitled to the same deference as the board members, independence and good faith investigation, then the question really is, how in Nevada should we allow the presumption to be rebutted? That's really the fundamental question. Isn't the analysis different than what has been undertaken in New York and in Delaware?
I don't believe the analysis.
And by the way, let me just finish. And if it is summary judgment, aren't we putting the courts in the exact same position that all of this jurisprudence says, regardless of what state, a judge should not be doing? And that is second-guessing the actions taken by an independent board who acts in good faith under that presumption.
To answer your last question first, we're not putting a judge in an improper position. The judge, we agree that an SLC standard, if it's an SLC or it's a board, once you have an established evaluative body, whether it's the board or the SLC, that is established to be independent and in good faith, the judge absolutely grants deference. Neither side disagrees with that. It's the question of how do you get to the point of establishing the independence and good faith? And it happens two separate ways. In Schoen, we have a statute that says the starting point is the board gets deference. The board gets a presumption that it's independent and in good faith, and then it's up to the shareholders to present evidence. And there's a legion of case law that identifies what kind of evidence overcomes a presumption. In this case, a 40-year loving familial relationship where the kids call an uncle and they vacation together and they love each other, that would overcome any presumption. There's no way that satisfies or doesn't get past the hump. In an SLC standard, because your evaluative board is handpicked by an already conflicted board, the antenna's up and the stakes are raised. No presumption's given to that board. They've got to prove it. And they've got to prove it in a way that the statutes don't contemplate. Perhaps if the board itself was independent and picked an SLC, perhaps a presumption could apply. But when a board admits it's already conflicted, Justice Hardesty, under your analysis, it would be possible, and under Mr. Peet's analysis, that the board handpicks the SLC. It puts Mr. Ergen, Mrs. Ergen, and one person on the board, and then the court starts with the presumption that that board deserves independence and good faith. And yet the wrongdoer himself.
Isn't that what our statute requires as the starting point?
Only if it's a board itself that identifies itself as independent, not if it's an SLC that's been handpicked. And that's why Zapata and Auerbach go farther, and Hassan goes farther to say, we can't give that presumption. Because if the wrongdoer sits on the SLC, and the board picks the wrongdoer and says, I'm going to let you sit on the SLC, how in the world could the judge decide, starting from scratch, we're giving the presumptions. That's why
it appears that this judge was influenced by the independent vote and basically the veto power of the third person. Now, you had commented, and I wonder if you could just expand, Chief, if that's all right, just one final question. Could you expand, please, on your view? What evidence in the record would you point me to, at least, that causes an error in the court's conclusion that the third member of the SLC was not independent?
Well, the evidence that we presented was that Mr. Lewis and his wife were best friends with Mr. Irvin's best friend. A tie that's not direct, it's not, and we didn't present that it was as extreme as Mr. Ortoff or Mr. Burka, because it wasn't. But he clearly wasn't independent in the way that you would want. But the problem is that the committee as a whole has to act independently. And again, if the court is going to allow one person in the minority to create or somehow cure obvious beholdenness and obvious independence, it's going to have to take it to the end result to say it's okay for Mr. Irvin and Mrs. Irvin to sit on this board also, just as long as Mr. Lewis votes the right way. But that would not only, it eliminates or doesn't take into effect or consideration the way commissions are formed, how they reach decisions. And to say that Mr. Lewis is going to be able to fight off Mr. Irvin any better than any other person has been able to, it gets the court and the judges into a rabbit hole which it shouldn't get to. The board and SLC itself should be independent, at least the majority. In this case, it's not. And if not, and if you're going to allow a minority person to somehow save it and create independence, we're going to go down a rabbit hole that's going to be very hard to put a test on.
I guess in this context, and I said one more question, but I apologize. I guess in this context, if the basis for the court's decision was this one individual had the veto power, what would we do in a case in which the board selected only one person to make this determination?
If, as Boone Family Trust says, if you want a perfectly independent board, pick it. And if the SLC decides it wants to pick one person who is completely independent and can pass the test, I don't see why they couldn't. There might be some case law that says otherwise, I'm not sure. But if the board wanted Mr. Lewis to be their SLC, they should have picked Mr. Lewis to be their SLC. And instead they picked Mr. Ortoff and Mr. Brokaw first. And only after we showed the extreme beholdenness did they try to put Lewis on their clerk. This case should be remanded, this case should be reversed, because they didn't meet their standard. In order for them to beat a standard, to satisfy the court and have a motion to defer granted, they have to meet the summary judgment standard. Since they did not, this court should reverse the order granting the motion to defer, send this case back to court, revert it to the appellants for their protection and their consideration, and let them take it to trial.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvester.
Thank you. Thank you for the extra time.
Your challenging arguments and briefs in this matter, and this matter will stand submitted. Thank you very much.